Condon concluded that he could better contribute to the war effort by returning to Westinghouse and working on radar technology. He left saddened and perplexed by Oppie's apparent unwillingness to defy Groves. Condon was unaware that Oppenheimer had yet to receive his own security clearance. The Army security bureaucracy was still trying to block Oppenheimer's clearance, and Oppie knew he could not press Groves about security, not if he wanted to keep his job. Oppenheimer had much invested in his relationship with Groves. The previous autumn, each man had taken the measure of the other and arrogantly calculated that he could dominate their relationship. Groves believed the charismatic physicist was essential to the success of the project. And precisely because Oppenheimer came with left-wing political baggage, Groves thought he could use Oppie's past to control him. Robert's calculation was equally straightforward. He understood that he could keep his job only if Groves continued to consider him far and away the best director available. He realized that his communist associations gave Groves a certain hold over him, but by demonstrating his unique competence, he believed he would convince the general to allow him to run the laboratory as he saw fit. Oppenheimer didn't disagree with Condon. He too was convinced that onerous security regulations could smother the scientists. But he was confident that over time he would prevail. After all, in the end, Groves needed Oppenheimer's skills as much as Oppenheimer needed Groves' approval. In retrospect, they were a perfect team to lead the effort to beat Germans in the race to build a nuclear weapon. If Robert's style of charismatic authority tended to breed consensus, Groves exercised his authority through intimidation. Basically, his way of running projects, observed Harvard chemist George Kistiakowsky, was to scare his subordinates to a point of blind obedience. Robert Serber thought that with Groves it was a matter of policy to be as nasty as possible to his subordinates. Oppie's secretary, Priscilla Green Duffield, always remembered how the general would stride past her desk and, without even a hello, say something rude such as, "Your face is dirty." This crude behavior made Groves the object of most of the complaints on the Mesa, and this deflected criticism from Oppenheimer. But Groves refrained from such behavior around Oppenheimer, and it was a measure of Oppenheimer's leverage in their relationship that he usually got his way. Robert did what was necessary to appease Groves. He became what the general wanted, a deft and efficient administrator. At Berkeley, his office desk had typically been stacked with foot-high piles of paper. Dr. Louis Hempelman, the Berkeley physician who came to Los Alamos and became the Oppenheimer's close friend, observed that on the Mesa, Robert was a clean desk man. Never any paper there. There was also a physical transformation. Oppie cut his long, curly hair. "He had his hair so closely clipped," remarked Hempelman, "I almost didn't recognize him." In point of fact, even as Condon was quitting Los Alamos, Groves' compartmentalization policy was breaking down. Oppenheimer may have avoided a confrontation over the issue, but the policy was becoming a sham. As the work progressed, it became increasingly important to have all white badge scientists free to discuss their ideas and problems with each other. Even Edward Teller understood that compartmentalization was an impediment to efficiency. Early in March 1943, he explained to Oppenheimer that he had written an official letter to him discussing my old anxiety, too much secrecy. But then he confided, "I did not do so to annoy you, but to give you a possibility to use the statement at any time in case you see an advantage in doing so." Groves soon realized what he was up against. Try as he might, he could not even get the most responsible and senior scientist to cooperate. On one occasion, when Ernest Lawrence was visiting Los Alamos and due to lecture there to a small group of scientists, Groves took the physicist aside and carefully briefed him on what he was not allowed to say to his audience. To his dismay, just a few moments later, Groves heard Lawrence up at the blackboard saying, "I know General Groves doesn't want me to say this, but..." Officially, nothing changed. But in practice, compartmentalization among the scientists grew more and more lax. Groves often blamed the collapse of compartmentalization on Condon's influence over Oppenheimer. "He did a tremendous amount of damage at Los Alamos in the initial setup," Groves testified in 1954. "I could never make up my own mind as to whether Dr. Oppenheimer was the one who was primarily at fault in breaking up the compartmentalization, or whether it was Dr. Condon." It was one thing, he thought, to have the top 20 to 30 scientists freely talking to each other. But when hundreds of men ignored the policy, compartmentalization became a joke. Groves eventually came to recognize that at Los Alamos, the rules of science had trumped the principles of military security. "While I may have dominated the situation in general," he testified, "I didn't have my own way in a lot of things. So when I say that Dr. Oppenheimer did not always keep the faith with respect to the strict interpretation of the security rules, if I could say that he was no worse than any of my other leading scientists, I think that would be a fair statement." In May 1943, Oppenheimer presided over a meeting in which it was decided that a general colloquium would be held every other Tuesday evening. He persuaded Teller to organize the meetings. When Groves said he was disturbed by the wide-ranging scope of these discussions, Oppie replied quite firmly that he was committed to the colloquia. His only concession was to agree to restrict attendance to scientists. He also argued adamantly that his people had to be able to exchange information with their counterparts at other Manhattan Project sites.
That June, for instance, he insisted on Enrico Fermi being permitted to visit Los Alamos from the Met Lab in Chicago. He told Groves that because Fermi's trip was of the highest importance, he simply would not take responsibility for its cancellation. Groves relented and Fermi was allowed to visit.